This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Hello and welcome to Democracy North, this week on Media Mornings, a roundup of the top interviews and headlines from the past week's daily Media Mornings show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, and also you can find us on iTunes and the Rabble Podcast Network. I'm David Ball, your host for this week, broadcasting from the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. We broadcast news and headlines from our team of producers and interviewers to make some sense of the headlines, bringing you news and perspectives and culture you won't find anywhere else. Well, on this week's show, we're really excited to present a packed roster of guests. First up is Elizabeth May. She's the leader of the Green Party of Canada and the MP for Saanich Gulf Islands. We spoke to her from the Senate chambers right after the throne speech, outlining the Prime Minister Stephen Harper's next priorities for the legislative session. We'll find out why she's concerned that citizens are being replaced in the government's rhetoric by consumers. We'll also hear from Helen Kennedy. She's with EGAL, talking about youth suicide prevention, particularly with LGBT youth across Canada. It's an epidemic, and Jane Bowie talked to her this week about that. Reuben George will also be speaking. This week there was a protest at the Kinder Morgan terminal in Burnaby, BC, and Greenpeace activists chained themselves to the machinery and hung banners. But before that, the Tsleil Waututh Nation held a canoe event ceremony on the water, praying for the end of the pipeline and that its project will not be approved to increase the flow of oil from the oil sands through the coast with tankers. I also spoke with Seth Klein and Christine Boyle about imagining a moral economy. We'll find out about that from them.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
I've continued to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
But first, this week's news headlines. In our top news story this week, police cars were set ablaze near a reserve north of Moncton, New Brunswick, on Monday as RCMP clashed with Native protesters who are trying to prevent seismic testing at a proposed shale gas development near the community. The violence erupted after Mounties arrived at the compound on Thursday, owned by SWN Resources, to enforce an injunction obtained by the company to stop a blockade erected by members of Elspagog First Nation. The chief of Elspagog, Susan Levi-Peters, said there are six police cars there on fire, alight after the arrest of Elspagog Chief War Chief Aaron Salk and several council members. Native leaders said that the police arrived with guns drawn. But as the Globe and Mail reports, Levi-Peters said there are people who have been tasered. She's acted as a go-between between the police and members of the community, actively trying to stop the development, which they believe will lead to fracking operations that cause irreparable environmental degradation to the reserve and the surrounding area, and earthquake risks. Plastic bullets have been fired and the police have dogs, she said. Some of the protesters, warriors from Elspagog First Nation, were inside the compound that houses SWN's equipment, and other members of the community are surrounding it. She described the situation as Oka all over again, and sad because we said all we need is public consultation. Meanwhile, APTN reports that one of the camouflaged police officers involved in the gun-drawn raid shouted at protesters, quote, Aboriginal land belongs to the government, not to fucking natives. And one protester shouted back, "See what happens, you want another officer to go down." An apparent reference to the police officer shot and killed at the 1990 Oka standoff over a golf course being built on a Mohawk cemetery. Drumming, cursing, and crying and barking dogs echoed through the air tinged with the smell of tear gas and sage this morning as tense scene unfolded. Three schools are on lockdown in the area as a precaution. Now in federal news, Prime Minister Stephen Harper has promised to befriend consumers, enshrined balanced budgets in law, and seal a free trade deal with Europe quickly in his latest throne speech on Wednesday night. According to Post Media, within minutes of his government releasing its speech from the throne, read by Governor General David Johnston, it was announced that Harper would jet to Brussels on Thursday to complete free trade deal talks with the President of the European Commission. The trip means that after proroguing Parliament and shutting it down in September following the summer break, Harper won't actually be in the House of Commons for question period today, Thursday, to face opposition parties over the growing Senate expense scandal that reached into his office earlier this year. NDP leader Tom Mulcair was dismissive of the throne speech as just another political gamesmanship in which the Tories try to borrow NDP consumer policies but aren't really serious. Mulcair said Harper's planned absence from question period the day after a throne speech is unprecedented, but that he will eventually answer questions on how his former chief of staff, Nigel Wright, paid $90,000 to Senator Mike Duffy, allegedly to shut him up. But the speech was not without controversy. After barring reporters from covering one of Prime Minister Harper's speeches, the Conservative Party decried what it claimed was a new low for Ottawa media elite, because some TV cameras refused to film the event if reporters weren't allowed inside, as had been allowed in the past. And the PMO has clashed recently with people trying to ask questions. One CTV cameraman was reportedly nearly banned from an overseas trip last week after shouting an impromptu question during one Harper event. While during the summit, the RCMP whisked away a reporter who tried to seize a microphone for reporters asking questions during Mr. Harper's northern trip. Meanwhile, as APTN reports, Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo said Canada was not an empty land as he responded to the throne speech, which claimed that pioneers forged a country where none otherwise would have existed. Referring to the coming 150th anniversary of Confederation, the speech described a country founded by leaders of courage and audacity, facing down geographic, military, and economic challenges to create Canada. But Atleo said the statement echoed the legal theory of terra nullius and the doctrine of discovery, used by European powers to justify the conquest of North America. As Atleo said, the Indigenous nations pre-existed the establishment of Canada. Now in Burnaby, BC, Greenpeace members chained themselves to parts of the Kinder Morgan facility to oppose the expansion of oil pipelines in BC. With two people at the front gate, more than a dozen Greenpeace activists made it inside the facility on Burrard Inlet. Mounties spoke to the protesters, who remained on the property and spray-painted anti-pipeline slogans on oil tanks and unfurled anti-tar sands banners. Westridge Terminal is the terminus station of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, running from Alberta's oil sands to BC. Kinder Morgan has applied to twin the pipeline, which would nearly triple its capacity for oil sands oil flowing from Alberta and loaded onto tankers for export. Oil opponents of both pipelines and tankers have also targeted Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway pipeline. Now in Indigenous news, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples called on the Harper government this week to reverse course on three major fronts in order to avoid a rocky road in its relationship with the country's First Nations population. According to APTN, during an Ottawa press conference Tuesday, marking the end of his nine-day tour through Canada, James Anaya said the country faces a crisis when it comes to the situation of Indigenous peoples. He added that the well-being gap between First Nations and non-Aboriginal people in Canada continues to grow, and that he witnessed high levels of distrust amongst Aboriginal peoples towards governments at both federal and provincial levels. He said First Nations people are still suffering from multiple legacies of the history of colonization, treaty infringements, assault on their cultures, and land dispossession. In prison news, a strike by federal prison inmates over a recent government pay cut to wages paid for institutional work has sparked a fundraising campaign with the goal of letting activists in solidarity with the prisoners show supportive solidarity. Up until last week, inmates had been getting anywhere from $1 to $6.90 as a daily allowance for taking part in a program assignments and for working various jobs in the prison. But a pay cut of 30% ordered by the federal government came into effect, prompting a protest that has spread to prisons across the country. The wage slash means prisoners have a tougher time keeping in touch with their families, save up for their eventual releases, or purchase essential items while in prison. According to the newly created Prisoner Strike Support Network, or PSSN, the statement issued Wednesday said it had launched an online fundraising campaign in hopes of raising $4,000. That's enough to send a one-time gift of $6.90 to each of the 600 inmates in Stoney in Manitoba. And other prisons across the country had echoed this fundraising campaign. That figure is the highest paid federal prisoners made per day prior to the wage cut. There is a National Day of Action planned for October 23rd. South of the border, Republican leaders conceded defeat in their two-week battle to derail Barack Obama's health care reforms. On Wednesday, they agreed to a series of votes likely to reopen the government and avert a looming debt default. The Guardian reports that within just hours until a deadline set by the U.S. Treasury for extending the debt limit, House Speaker John Boehner with the Republicans signaled he was ready to accept a Senate-drafted peace deal containing almost no concessions to conservatives who had driven the country to the brink of a new financial crisis. Harry Reid, the Democrat Senate Majority Leader, announced the deal on the floor of the Senate just after midday Wednesday. Mitch McConnell, Republican Minority Leader, acknowledged the fight was over and said the shutdown and debt crisis should be over later this week. The deal crafted will fund the government until the 15th of January. In Colombia, a regional governor has been arrested on charges of murder and conspiracy. The governor of La Guajira province, San Francisco Gomez, is accused of murdering his political rivals. As the BBC reports, he is also accused of links to right-wing paramilitaries and criminal gangs. Colombia's deputy attorney general said that Gomez was linked to the assassination of Barrancas town councillor Luis López Peralta in 1997, as well as the murder of Luis Alejandro Rodriguez and Rosa Mercedes Cabrera in 2000. Gomez is also accused of criminal involvement with paramilitary right-wing groups in La Guajira. There have been frequent allegations of links between the Colombian government, which has a free trade deal with Canada that does not include human rights provisions, and right-wing paramilitaries accused of gross human rights abuses against civilians. In China, the authorities in a city in eastern of the country are on high alert after angry residents clashed with police over the government's flood relief efforts. Armed police are out in force in Yuyao in Zhejiang province after thousands of people protested in front of the government office there, throwing stones and overturning vehicles. Residents say little was done to help Typhoon Fito, which struck last week. Residents said have been in confrontation with authorities, complaining about what they said was a slow government response to widespread flooding caused by the typhoon. Their anger was fueled, they said, by state-run media, which praised the government's relief efforts. Online photographs show some protesters trying to dismantle the Communist Party's mantra, "Serve the people," mounted at the entrance of the government building. Meanwhile, the Communist Party criticized the violence, adding that residents should, quote, "express their rational demands at an appropriate time and in an appropriate manner." In Iranian news, negotiating teams from the world powers have arrived and Iran at the UN's European offices in Geneva for fresh talks on Tehran's controversial nuclear program. The first such negotiations since the election of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. As Al Jazeera reports, the talks Tuesday and Wednesday will involve representatives of Iran and permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. The Iranian foreign minister said that there was a good first reaction to Tehran's proposals. In Russia, relatives of 28 Greenpeace activists and two journalists held on piracy charges after an oil rig demonstration last month have called on Moscow to behave in a sensible manner and expedite their release. As The Guardian reports, security forces detained 28 of the group's activists and two freelance journalists aboard of a Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise on 19th of December after a protest at an offshore oil platform owned by Russia's state-owned energy firm Gazprom. And finally, nearly 30 million people around the world are living as slaves, according to a new index ranking 162 countries. The Global Slavery Index 2013 says that India has the highest number of people living in conditions of slavery at 14 million, followed by Mauritania, which has the highest proportional figure of 4% of its population currently enslaved. The report's author, by the Walk Free Foundation, based in Australia, was aimed at having governments tackle what they called a hidden crime. Well, that is our news headlines for this week on Media Mornings. Stay tuned for our first interview with Elizabeth May of the Green Party. We'll be right back. Well, for our first interview this week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 and at w2media.ca/thisweek. Democracy Now! Is a weekly top roundup of our headlines and interviews, and you can find us as well on Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. Well, our first interview is with Elizabeth May. She's the leader of the Green Party of Canada, as well as the MP representing Saanich and Gulf Islands in BC. We spoke to her inside the Senate chambers Wednesday night, right after the throne speech from Stephen Harper. Here's what she had to say.
Thanks for calling in to Media Mornings, Elizabeth. Could you maybe start off just talking about the overall mood on Parliament Hill right now in the wake of the throne speech?
Well, I'm afraid, you know, it's always a very funny mood on the first day back. So for a lot of us, I have to say the mood is kind of like a bunch of kids coming back to school after summer holidays. And even though most MPs actually do work throughout the summer, I know I did, there's a fair bit, more than most Canadians would imagine, of convivial greetings across party lines. A lot of us are friends with each other regardless of what party we're in. Fortunately for me, that's true, because I'm the only member of the Green Party here. If I didn't have friends in other parties, I'd be pretty lonesome. So that part of the mood is fairly upbeat, because people are a bit more rested, a bit less frazzled, a bit less partisan. The speech from the throne did nothing for most people. There was very, very little new in it, and a pretty uninspired agenda for the next 2 years.
Could you talk a bit about why you feel it's uninspired? I mean, the main points are on budgetary control and consumer rights, it seems.
Well, I wrote a speech on the throne I would do if I were Prime Minister right now, and it's, let's have a citizens first agenda. I think it demeans us as a people and as citizens in a democracy when we are described primarily as consumers and as if our biggest concern in the world is high cell phone rates and roaming fees. Now, those are certainly annoying, and it's important to bring them down, but compared to fighting the climate crisis, to addressing the growing deficit in Canadian democracy, a very frightening level of control within Parliament itself, where the Prime Minister's office makes all the decisions and suppresses science and bullies the civil service and controls everything that MPs do, I think there are much larger issues for Canada than the ones that are sketched out on these few pages. And although there are references to some of the issues, there's reference here and there to the plight of First Nations, the need for justice for First Nations peoples, very, very thin details on the most important issues, and a great deal of verbiage about how we're a warrior nation and we use our military might sparingly. I don't think anybody in the rest of the world has ever looked at Canada and thought that they were lucky that Canada's military might was used sparingly.
So you actually wrote your own speech from the throne. Were you hoping that the Governor General might accidentally pick it up and read it instead?
That would be quite the accident. That would be a real career ender for our friend Donald Johnson. But one of the reasons I did is to think about what is the real role of the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister in Canada, traditionally and under our Constitution, should be the first among equals. The Prime Minister's role is not to be the King of Canada, the Emperor in charge of all decisions. But what we have increasingly, and it's a trend that started under Pierre Trudeau, but it's rapidly accelerated, particularly under Stephen Harper, is that we have so much power centralized in the Prime Minister's office that for all intents and purposes in a majority government, it's an elected dictatorship. And that is extremely worrying and very anti-democratic. And we need to deal with that. In Canada, we do not elect our Prime Minister. The only people who voted for Stephen Harper are the people in his riding of Calgary Southwest.
The Senate chamber where it was read is, of course, the same location that Brigitte Lepape held up her Stop Harper sign a few years back in the speech from the throne. Was there any reference to the Senate scandal in the throne speech?
Yes, there was a minor reference towards the end of the speech that the Harper administration would continue to try to find ways to address reform of the Senate. They basically say that they find the status quo in the Senate unacceptable. I think most Canadians would agree. The Senate must be reformed or be abolished, and the government will work once it gets the advice from the Supreme Court of Canada. I don't think they can say more than that, because it does require opening the Constitution to figure out how to reform the Senate, whereas I think the much more pressing issues are how to reform the House of Commons. It's the democratically elected side of our system of government. We have a very dysfunctional electoral system where we variously called winner take all or first past the post, which is the only way in a democracy that you could possibly have a majority of the seats elected with the minority of the votes, and that really needs to be dealt with.
The NDP put a motion forward, a point of privilege, on the Senate scandal and Mike Duffy. It seems like quite a clever maneuver in terms of the fact that the Conservatives had hoped that wouldn't come up.
No way of avoiding it coming up, whether by the NDP today or by the committees that are forming. There'll be investigations. The key question, I think, that requires an answer is why did Nigel write a personal check for $90,000 to Mike Duffy? There are, I think Stephen Harper will try to avoid that question by throwing as many Senate scandals as possible into the same pot, and they'll be pursuing any Liberal senators who misspent their housing allowance. They'll be very happy to throw Pamela Wallin under a bus to take attention off of Mike Duffy. You know, it's not to say in any way or to minimize misspending. I'm the only member of Parliament who has, from the minute I was elected, put all of my expenses online. The original receipts are scanned. Everything's there for people to see. But the reality of Senate misspending is that it's a much, much smaller scandal than the big question of why did the Prime Minister's own chief of staff write a personal check for $90,000 to one senator to then have him use that money to repay the money he owes. Why would they do that for Mike Duffy? And what is it that Mike Duffy, I mean, it's pretty clear he holds something over them to get that done, and I'd like to know what that is. If it's nothing, if it was just a generous gesture from Nigel Wright to part with $90,000 personally for someone who is not a close friend, well, that would be an explanation worth pursuing.
Of course, the allegations of the RCMP investigator, who's actually been filing court documents, Matthews, has actually that Duffy was given the money on condition that he stopped speaking in the media.
Exactly. So there's something they wanted him not to talk about. And the question is, what is it they want him not to talk about? The other thing that's interesting, of course, is that for Stephen Harper to claim he knew nothing about it when it turns out that Plan A was the Conservative Party itself would write the check for Mike Duffy, and they only decided they wouldn't when they found out that the amount required was $90,000 instead of $30,000. I didn't know they had a Conservative Party fund that was there to write money, to write checks for people who had overspent them or falsely and fraudulently claimed money. But why the Conservative Party was prepared to spend $30,000 and not $90,000, and what it was, this is the key point, is what is it that they don't want Mike Duffy to talk about? There are a number of questions that come to mind, and a number of the factual situation around Mike Duffy's appointment to the Senate suggests some answers. I can't make any connections there without evidence, but I sure would like to have the question put to Mike Duffy and Nigel Wright under oath. What are the reasons for the check being requested, and what were the reasons for the check being written?
My last question for you, Elizabeth, I'm not sure if you saw the article on the satirical website, The Beaverton, that you'd expelled yourself from your own party because you hadn't towed your party line?
Yeah, that was a little silly. We actually have a policy. We will never have a party whip. When we have more Green MPs, our job, and I understand my job, is to represent the voters of Saanich Gulf Islands. That is my number one responsibility. It's a huge honor and privilege to represent the voters of Saanich Gulf Islands. And that should be the number one priority of all MPs, should be to represent their constituents, not their political party. And we would never do what all the other parties do, which is insist that we have this slavish party discipline that everybody vote down the party line. That is not something the Green Party will ever do.
So the Beaverton was not correct in quoting you as saying that you're a loose cannon.
No, but I'm afraid one of the things I often say is that I yearn for the day when I have a large and unruly caucus.
Thank you for joining us today, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much. Good talking to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And that was Elizabeth May, leader of the Green Party of Canada, and she holds a MP seat for Saanich Gulf Islands, the first Green MP in the country. We talked to her in the Senate right after the throne speech on Wednesday. We'll be right back speaking with Egal Canada about preventing youth suicide. You're listening to Democracy North this week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio CFRO 100.5 FM and online at w2media.ca. Well, I'm David Ball, your host for this week, and you can also find us on the Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. Our next interview is going to be with Helen Kennedy. She's the executive director of EGAL Canada, and talked to Jane Bowie earlier this week about youth suicide prevention and LGBT youth. Here's Helen Kennedy, interviewed on our program on Wednesday.
Good morning, Helen.
Good morning, Jane. How are you?
I'm very well, and it's great to have you on the show.
So, yeah, thank you. It's really nice to be here.
Okay, we don't have as much time as I had hoped, so we just move really quickly into our discussion. And, you know, I think it's most obvious to our listeners that something needs to happen to prevent this disproportionate rate of suicides. And why did EGAL look at having a summit?
Well, it's it really came about after the suicide of the Ottawa teen, Jamie Hubley, and mm-hmm. a number of other teens, actually. There was one 13-year-old in particular, Shaquille Wisdom, who was hounded by his peers in school, and eventually he did commit suicide after his peers threw him in a dumpster. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a number of forgotten names and voices that mm-hmm. LGBTQ identified that we wanted to highlight and to actually put names on these youth who were taking their own lives. Mm-hmm. So we got a number of 50 experts from across North America. We gathered them in Toronto in 2012. And we held basically Canada's or North America's first national discussion on LGBT teen suicide. Mm-hmm. And the outcomes are contained in our report with 20 recommendations of some of the things that we should be addressing.
Mm-hmm. So I know that the first recommendation in the report recognizes and addresses the diversity of LGBTQ youth experiences across the country, and I think that's particularly important. I know here in BC, the rate of suicide of Aboriginal two-spirited youth is extraordinarily high. So to understand sort of the intersections of what youth go through, and that is one of the recommendations, is really key, it seems to me.
Yeah, totally, and we were very aware of that when we were putting our 50 experts together, and there were a number of two-spirit identified people participating, and it was one of the key outcomes all through the discussion was around our Indigenous and Aboriginal youth and how we were going to address the disparity in the numbers, in particular, between two-spirited, the LGB community, and what's happening within the trans community. Mm-hmm. So these were key factors for us and issues that needed to be addressed. And two things that have happened since the report was released mm-hmm. is that we have established a relationship with the Canadian Conference of Coroners, where we've developed a protocol for the coroners right across the country of some key questions to ask following the suicide of youth. So that is something that the coroners are looking at now to implement. I know in Ontario they are going to implement it. So we're working very, very hard and closely with the Canadian Conference of Coroners to implement these guidelines and protocols for such investigations. One of the other areas that we are developing is an awareness campaign for parents. What are the key identifiers? What should you be looking for? Mm-hmm. As a parent, how should you be monitoring the mental health and well-being of your children? Because most parents don't know the sexual orientation of their children until after they have committed suicide. So they never know that their child potentially was LGB identified until after their child takes their own life.
Yeah, that would be part of why the numbers seem to be so much higher now than in the past, is that before often these youths were never identified.
That's right. And we don't have statistics in Canada that identify these youth mm-hmm. as LGBTQ.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's key to work with the coroners so we can start to get some of the numbers so then we can approach governments with policy recommendations when, you know, for Health Canada and any policy change at all. Unless we have those numbers, you know, we don't have any real credible evidence that a lot of these youth are LGBT.
I've heard some people say that the real issue is mental health, and it doesn't matter people's gender identity, sexual orientation, their ethnic background, their race. What matters is their mental health, and that's what's key. Your response to that, and why it's important to identify, to have specific resources around LGBTQ youth?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a key question, in that mental health versus mental illness. We know that when our youth are harassed constantly in school and they're being bullied on a regular basis, when they're not out at home, when they're totally closeted, and you know this, when they're not included in the school environment, whether it be reflected in curriculum or whether the policies in the school do not reflect sexual orientation or gender identity, that is all contributing to a person's mental health, safety, and well-being. It's not, you know, it's the key factor for the suicide may not be because the person identifies as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or trans, right? There are a number of factors that may contribute to the actual the death, but for sure, when you are closeted and when you don't feel safe and when your mental health is affected on a regular basis, then that is a contributing factor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I do think that there's a distinct line between mental health and mental illness,
mm-hmm.
And that's something that is significant in terms of the determining factor for why these youths are taking their own lives.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the other recommendations in the report?
Yeah, I mean, some of them are very specific to the work that we're currently doing in the education system across the country.
Mm-hmm.
There's recommendations to develop and implement LGBTQ inclusive curriculum in all subjects at all grade levels, whether it be elementary, secondary, post-secondary. Implement LGBT specific suicide prevention public awareness campaigns. Integrate, obviously, youth voice into all of the activities around this issue, to convene a task force consisting of Canada's First Nation and Aboriginal people to discuss this issue with a specific focus on Two-Spirit. Yeah, I mean, we're also looking at all provincial and territorial governments to appoint a resource and chief suicide prevention officer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's comprehensive.
It's very comprehensive. And we'll make sure that we put the link up to the report on our website so that folk who want to get more of the information can find that and also find how they can support the work of the EGAL Human Rights Trust in carrying out this work.
Yeah, fantastic. And we're doing another summit in Montreal in 2014, in May 2014.
Okay. Well, thanks so
All
much.
Right.
Thanks so much, Helen, and it's always a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, thanks a million, Jane. Take
All
care.
Right, bye.
And that one was Helen Kennedy, Executive Director of EGAL Canada, interviewed by Jane Bowie in our program on Wednesday. We'll be back to talk with Reuben George. He was speaking out at a prayer ceremony at the Kinder Morgan Terminal in Burnaby, BC. We'll find out more about why people are opposing tankers and pipelines from Alberta's oil sands. Listening to Democracy North, the best programs from this week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver, as well as online at the Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. You can find us at w2media.ca/thisweek. Well, for our next interview, Erwin Ustindi traveled to Tsleil-Waututh territory at a prayer ceremony at the Kinder Morgan terminal in Burnaby, BC. He spoke with Ruben George, Sundance chief. Here's Ruben talking about the Kinder Morgan pipeline that would go through their territory. Here's Ruben.
There was a protest, a Thanksgiving ceremony out on the water in the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, hosted Squamish Nation and Musqueam paddles, and this comes on the backdrop of the federal government stepping up its efforts to promote its ideas for resource extraction and pushing pipelines. A couple of segments we're going to quickly play here for until the end of the program. Ruben George was the event was widely picked up by the media. CTV Global had helicopters. APTN, CBC French, CBC English, several newspaper reporters, and radio CKWX, CKNW. And the message was about protecting the Salish Seas and uniting both as Indigenous people and allies and neighbors to protect the Salish Seas against Kinder Morgan's expansion plans for tripling the capacity of their pipeline and bringing oil tankers in the harbor every single day. There was a large tanker there yesterday, and we're going to go to some audio now that the Vancouver Indigenous Media Arts Festival, the VIMAF crew, recorded. And here is Ruben George in his own words.
My heart is already full. And those waters right here, I played in the water. I ate out of the water. Our ancestors have said for a long time that when the tide went out, the table was set. At times close to here, there would be sometimes 50 people out on the water, harvesting clam and crab. Later in life, I learned to do ceremony out of this water. We practice and oar canoes in these waters. An elder said, when he's rubbing one of our canoes, he said, the scripts of your people are written and stated at the bottom of these canoes. Our history was on the bottom of these canoes. Are still here. The spirit is still strong. For these things that we receive out of the water is only good things. We only receive goodness from the water. That's all we want going back. Really proud moment today to be with our relations that we're related to with Squamish. Our relations we're related to in Musqueam. To travel together as one heart, one mind, and one prayer is not some all together as one family. For many generations, the government tried to separate us. Just like the prayer that is in the bottom of the history of what we have is in the bottom of the canoes, it's also in our hearts and in our blood. It's who we are. Not some mud. We will paddle together as one heart and one mind. And we will do a prayer at Kinder Morgan. Because the only thing that we should be putting into the water is the same thing we get out, is goodness. And what they're putting into the water is not good. We will stand up for our future generations, but also humanity's future generations. The leadership of this country stand behind the industry that is ruining this country. Our relations are dying at the Alberta tar sands. Let's keep them in our mind and in our hearts when we paddle today.
And that is the voice of Ruben George, the co-manager of the Tsleil Waututh Nation's Sacred Trust, which is the division of the Tsleil Waututh Nation, which is mandated to defend the territories and promote energy alternatives.
And that was Erwin Ustindi interviewing Reuben George at the paddle ceremony at the Kinder Morgan Terminal in Burnaby. And we're going to play a song. This is Fire Escape by Half Moon Run. Be right back with Seth Klein from Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives and Christine Boyle from Spirited Social Change to talk about a moral economy. Half Moon Run with Fire Escape. You're listening to Democracy North, the best interviews and headlines from this week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. You can also find our podcasts and archives online at w2media.ca, as well as on iTunes and the Rabble Podcast Network. Well, for our next interview, I spoke with Seth Klein and Christine Boyle. Seth Klein is the BC director of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, and Christine is a community organizer and director of Spirited Social Change. They authored a piece in the Tyee.ca this week called Imagining a Moral Economy for British Columbia. We think the lessons are applicable across the country, though here's Seth and Christine. I interviewed on our program Thursday.
Reading through your Imagining a Moral Economy for British Columbia article on the Tyee really strikes me this is a conversation that isn't happening in BC, but you feel it should. Could you say a bit, what is the moral economy?
We offered a definition in the piece, Dave, that I'll read out, that was that a moral economy is one in which people don't feel they have to sacrifice their values or harm human dignity or compromise ecological health in order to achieve economic security. It's an individual situation, and it's a systemic challenge, I think, for us to be creating a type of economy together in which people have those choices.
And I think you're right, Dave, that it's not part of the discussion most of the time when we talk about the economy. Certainly in the last provincial election, I don't think there was a moral dimension to the way we were talking about the economy. We had the hard hat tour on the one hand, and on the other hand, there was some discussion about inequality, but nobody asking what are the big questions, what are the big choices that we're making about what it is that we want to build as a province, and how does that square with some of the ethical dimensions of climate change and those sorts of larger moral questions.
Yeah, in fact, thinking about the BC election, it seemed like any attempt to inject a moral discussion into it actually ended up hurting the NDP or the Greens. That, in fact, the argument towards economic security, which was the basic argument that won the Liberals' election, was based purely on the sort of rational mathematics of how many jobs. So now we're hearing about 100,000 jobs being created in the tech sector, or in natural gas pipelines, or XXX. How can you counter that argument? Because it didn't really work for the NDP.
Well, this is sort of where we started the piece, which was to recognize that all of this is happening in the context of people feeling a lot of economic insecurity and fear about how they're going to earn a decent income and achieve a decent livelihood for their families. And so in the context of that insecurity, whoever came along sounding convincing that they could create more investment and more jobs won the day. And I guess what we were trying to achieve with the piece was to say, in a moral economy, wouldn't it be great if people didn't feel forced to make these choices where they have to park their values in order to achieve an income? And that's not to put some guilt trip on the individuals. That's about government primarily, and secondarily corporations, and saying, what are the big structure? And can we change these so that people have a different set of choices?
Hmm. You know, so further to your question, Dave, we're told we have these economic discussions as if economics is, you know, some pure science where there are just mathematical answers. When, of course, the reality is that it's all moral and ethical conversation. Budgets are moral documents. All our economic planning is outlining what we value and what we want to prioritize. And so to be pretending that our economics are just about this number of jobs in this industry and this is the best we can do and this and that is false. And it does all of us a disservice, not just in the type of world that we kind of bumble along in creating because we're not planning better, but it does us a disservice in suggesting that we don't know better and that we don't want better.
I mean, economists really do believe they're scientists a lot of the time. I remember in taking microeconomics courses in university and seeing the sort of classes' heads bobbing in agreement as the professor argued we should eliminate the minimum wage and get rid of all rent controls altogether and, have sweatshops. And he did it with just two lines on a graph, and everyone just agreed along with it, and it seemed very rational.
But interestingly, Dave, it didn't always used to be like that. It's only been like that in recent decades. Traditionally, economics was understood as a social science, and traditionally it was usually embedded in departments with political economy or with philosophy. Even Adam Smith, the grandfather of capitalism as we know it, was a philosopher. And so, historically, these economic questions were ones that were tackled by people interested in questions of ethics. And it's only in the last few decades that it's been, I think, falsely portrayed as this more pure science where everything can be modeled as you describe and portrayed, as Chris was saying, as value-free.
Hmm. Let's talk about morals for the last chunk of our interview, because people get uneasy about it. It has some religious connotations, perhaps, or some moralizing connotations, I guess, inherently. What is the main reason we don't have a moral framework in public? And
you know, we've been having this conversation for a while as well, and we actually struggled to articulate in the article what it is exactly that keeps us from going there. There is a huge amount of religious baggage, and I think especially in BC, it's an increasingly secular culture, and progressives are especially secular, and religious institutions have a tough history. I was raised in the United Church, and there's a huge recognition, I think, of the role of the United Church historically in the Indian residential schools, and so there's this hesitation to bring moral language out because of its connections to this, not just to the atrocities that religious institutions have been involved in the past, but to the kind of preachiness and judgmental tone of some religious folks still. And yet, historically in Canada, the religious left has been really influential and very significant in creating a lot of the institutions that we still value so highly. So it's a tension, absolutely, but it seems to be one in which for the last little while the political left and progressives have avoided reclaiming any of that language, and I think we're doing ourselves a disservice.
I love that our conversation between the three of us actually started at the Bowen Island Apple Festival last weekend and bumped into you there, and it seemed like nobody would sell me things. I wanted to buy them. They were just giving it all away for free, and like, I want to buy some apple cider. I'll buy lots of it. And they were like, no, just here's some more free cider. You can bring his apples if you want. I'm like, okay. It happened several times on the island, actually. But I do think it's interesting when you get out of that immediate framework, you can create more space for conversations that are akin to a dinner table conversation in a family.
Yeah,
Well, any last thoughts from either of you?
It's been great to have this conversation with you, Dave. It's been really exciting to have put this piece out and gotten to start seeing the reaction, and we are eager to continue the conversation in a whole bunch of ways.
And I think, I guess the last thing I would say is that, you know, it's not like an economy is either moral or not. All economies exist along the spectrum, and the truth is there's lots of, I mean, your little example of the Apple Fest is a good one. There's all kinds of areas in our current economy where this is already happening, where there's a more reciprocal and sharing economy, where people are engaged in caring for other people and protecting the environment. And conversely, a lot of the industries that are doing great harm, like oil and gas, are actually very small as a share of our economy. There's a tiny fraction of our provincial GDP and of employment, but yet those areas dominate the political discourse on the economy.
And that was Seth Klein, director of the BC office of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and Christine Boyle. She's with Spirited Social Change. Their piece, Imagining a Moral Economy for BC, is on the tie.ca. Well, that's our show for this week. Thank you for listening to Democracy North. You can find us at w2media.ca/this week. I'm David Ball. Thanks for listening.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at W2Media.ca.